From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The crimes of Israel against Gaza decrease day after day, and now it's terrorist crimes, you know. They are using terrorist weapons, murder, crimes against humanity.
Israeli forces are continuing to pound Gaza City, hitting civilian targets, including a UN building, a hospital, a building housing international media organizations, in some of the heaviest shelling in nearly 3 weeks. More than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed, most of them civilians. 13 Israelis have died. We'll get the latest. But first, a former transit officer in Oakland, California, has been arrested on murder charges in connection with the killing of an unarmed African-American man shot dead while he was lying face down on the ground on the train platform.
At this point, when you have a homicide that is intentional and there's no mitigation, it's more or less presumed to be a second-degree murder.
And retired Army General Eric Shinseki has his confirmation hearing to head the Department of Veterans Affairs. We'll speak with journalist Aaron Glantz, author of The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israel continues its relentless attack on Gaza with more bombings of civilian targets, including a crowded hospital. The past hours have seen some of the most intensive Israeli bombing of the 20-day assault. The Al-Quds Hospital was hit by Israeli shells, setting it ablaze. Around 500 patients were being treated inside. The attack followed an earlier Israeli strike that hit the main United Nations aid compound in Gaza City. More than 700 Palestinians had taken shelter there. United Nations Relief and Works Agency spokesperson Christopher Gunness said the compound's burning with flames from white phosphorus shells.
There have been three hits on the UNRWA headquarters, the UNRWA compound in Gaza, including, I'm told by John Ging, white phosphorus. Three of our staff members have been injured. The workshop in our compound is in flames, and nearby are loaded fuel tankers. So the situation is extremely dangerous and extremely serious. We've been on the phone to the Israeli authorities, asking them to call off their fire from around the compound of a neutral international organization. We've not had the answer we want.
The UN says the fire will burn down an entire warehouse storing thousands of tons of food, medical supplies, and other aid. A nearby Israeli shelling hit an office building housing several media organizations. A journalist for the Abu Dhabi television channel was injured. Reuters bureau chief Alistair MacDonald said the attack came despite contact with the Israeli military.
We were, in fact, at that time in contact with the Israeli army, checking with them that they knew where our staff were and where they were working. We were assured that they were. Shortly after that, an explosion hit the floor just above us. Shrapnel entered the office. It also struck the offices of another media company two floors above ours. One person at least there was wounded, we understand. We've evacuated our office.
Thousands of Palestinians have fled their homes today as Israel escalates its assault on densely populated residential areas. Gaza resident Nasser Mohammed said his family was forced to relocate twice after coming under Israeli attack.
We were inside a house with the children, and then the Israeli army started to shoot at us with bullets. So we moved to another house with the children. Then the second house came down on top of us.
The Palestinian death toll now stands at least 1,045, at least half of them civilian. Another 4,860 have been injured. 13 Israelis have been killed, including four soldiers, by friendly fire. The latest attacks come after a coalition of nine Israeli human rights groups called for an investigation into whether Israel's committing war crimes. In a statement, the groups, including the Israeli sections of Amnesty International and Physicians for Human Rights, condemned what they called the wanton use of lethal force against Palestinian civilians. They continue, "This kind of fighting constitutes a blatant violation of the laws of warfare and raises the suspicion of the commission of war crimes." There are worldwide calls for prosecuting Israeli leaders. On Wednesday, hundreds gathered outside the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Sobi Kansa of the International Coalition Against Impunity said Israeli leaders should be tried for crimes against humanity.
The crimes of Israel against Gaza decrease day after day, and now it's terrorist crimes, you know. They are using terrorist weapons, murder, crimes against humanity, war crimes. So for this we came to The Hague, to ICC court. We want the court to go and start investigation about these crimes.
The Guardian of London reported this week diplomats are considering asking the United Nations General Assembly to refer Israel's actions in Gaza to the World Court. The UN Special Rapporteur to the Occupied Territories, Richard Falk, has said Israel's attack on Gaza could be in violation of the UN Charter, the Geneva Conventions, international law, and international humanitarian law. And UNICEF has also condemned the Gaza attack. In a rare statement, UNICEF urged an immediate ceasefire, calling the deaths of children tragic and unacceptable. Bolivia and Venezuela, meanwhile, have cut diplomatic ties with Israel in protest of the Gaza assault. Bolivian President Evo Morales also back calls for investigating Israeli leaders.
The most serious international crimes should not go unpunished. Any government can back the investigation and punishment of these crimes. Bolivia, a sovereign state that shows it is against violence and respects life, will work with other governments and humanitarian organizations to ask for an investigation in international court for the crimes committed in the Gaza Strip by Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and other members of the Israeli cabinet.
A ship trying to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza says it's aborted its mission after the Israeli Navy threatened the civilian passengers on board. The Free Gaza Movement boat left Cyprus Wednesday seeking to deliver doctors and medical supplies. It was the group's first attempt to reach Gaza since an Israeli Navy vessel deliberately rammed another humanitarian boat last month, almost forcing it to sink. According to a Free Gaza statement, five Israeli gunboats surrounded the Spirit of Humanity ship in international waters 100 miles off the Gaza coast. In a radio transmission, the Israeli Navy threatened to open fire on the ship unless it immediately turned around. Meanwhile, the Israeli government has intercepted an Iranian ship headed to Gaza for the second time. The ship's carrying food and medicine and had planned to arrive in Gaza this past weekend. It tried to reach Gaza again Wednesday, but was intercepted by the Israeli Navy. And the U.S. has been forced to cancel a weapons shipment to Israel after the Greek government refused to allow it to pass through its ports. The U.S. says it will seek an alternative site. Osama bin Laden has resurfaced in a new audio tape calling for a holy war over the Israeli attack on Gaza. The undated recording condemns Israel and the United States.
We are with you and we will not let you down. Our fate is tied to yours in fighting the Crusader Zionist coalition, in fighting until victory or martyrdom. God has bestowed us with the patience to continue the path of jihad for another 7 years, and seven, and seven. The question is, can America continue its war with us for several more decades to come? Reports and evidence would suggest otherwise.
In Iraq news, Pentagon commanders are reportedly drafting contingencies for a speedier withdrawal of U.S. troops than currently planned. The Washington Post reports military officials ordered the new withdrawal plan in case President-elect Obama rejects current proposals as too slow. A federal judge has ruled the Pentagon must release a Guantanamo prisoner over lack of evidence to justify continued imprisonment. U.S. District Judge Richard Leon says the Pentagon's failed to prove Mohammed al-Gharani is a so-called enemy combatant. A Chad national, Gharani was arrested in Pakistan in 2002. He's been held at Guantanamo for more than 6 years. On Capitol Hill, the House has passed a measure expanding government health insurance for low-income children. President Bush has vetoed previous votes expanding the state children's health insurance program known as SCHIP. But President-elect Obama says it will be one of the first measures he hopes to sign into law when he takes office next week. The $33 billion bill will be funded in part by a tax increase on cigarettes. A Senate vote is expected next week. The Supreme Court's ruled evidence obtained through illegal searches or mistaken arrests can still be used to prosecute criminal cases. In a 5-4 ruling, the court voted to impose new limits on the so-called exclusionary rule, which dismisses evidence obtained from unreasonable searches or seizure. In a dissent, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said the ruling leaves suspects in exclusionary cases with, quote, no remedy for violations of their constitutional rights. The Bush administration's claiming it'll meet a legal requirement to hand over millions of emails it's long claimed to have lost. A government lawyer made the announcement at a hearing in a suit brought by civil liberties groups seeking the emails' public release. The announcement came hours after a district court judge ordered White House employees to search their hard drives for the missing emails dated from 2003 to 2005. One of the plaintiffs, the group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, says the government's claim to have recovered the emails should be verified independently. Another ruling is expected soon in a suit seeking to force Vice President Dick Cheney to hand over his personal records. Cheney says he should decide what gets publicly disclosed. And the Treasury Department's reportedly finalizing a new plan to give Bank of America billions of additional dollars on top of the $25 billion infusion it's already received in the taxpayer bailout. Bank of America says it needs the funds to complete the acquisition of the troubled firms Merrill Lynch and Countrywide. $10 billion of the $25 billion Bank of America received last year was earmarked for its purchase of Merrill Lynch. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. A former transit officer in Oakland, California, has been arrested on murder charges in connection to the killing of Oscar Grant. Grant is the unarmed African-American man who was shot dead on an Oakland train platform on New Year's Day. The shooting gained international attention after cell phone videos of the killing were posted on YouTube by train passengers. The videos show the officer, Johann Messerly, pulling out a gun and shooting 22-year-old Oscar Grant in the back while he was lying face down on the ground on the train platform. On Wednesday, Alameda County District Attorney Tom Orloff announced the charges against Messerly.
Murder charges were filed because at this point, what I feel the evidence indicates is an unlawful killing done by an intentional act. And from the evidence we have, there's nothing that would mitigate that to something lower than a murder. That doesn't mean that evidence might develop in the future, that particularly as it develops at trial. But at this point, when you have a homicide that is intentional and there's no mitigation, it's more or less presumed to be a second-degree murder.
The former police officer, Johannes Messerly, was arrested Tuesday in Nevada near Lake Tahoe.
Through their service,
Messerly resigned from the BART force after he refused to speak with criminal investigators. Several legal experts and law enforcement officials in California say they cannot recall any other instance of a police officer in California being charged with murder for an on-duty incident. The killing of Oscar Grant has sparked a series of protests in Oakland. On the night of January 7th, over 105 people were arrested in what's been described by some as the Oakland Rebellion, when some protesters set cars on fire and damaged over three dozen businesses. Another 18 protesters were arrested last night on vandalism charges after another large protest in Oakland. On Wednesday, a National Day of Nonviolent Action to protest the killing of Oscar Grant was held in over a dozen other cities. We're joined now in San Francisco by journalist and hip-hop activist Davey D. He runs the popular website Davey D's Hip Hop Corner and DaveyD.com. He's the co-host of Hard Knock Radio on KPFA in Berkeley. Davey D., welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you tell us what happened, the latest news, the indictment for murder of Johann Messerly and where he was found?
Well, he was found in Nevada on a fugitive warrant, and I think that was welcome news to many of the people that have been organizing and mobilizing around seeing justice in what is, you know, what most of us see as a straight-up execution. People are pretty clear this is the first step. It's good that he got arrested, We still have a lot of questions as to why it took 2 to 3 weeks for that to happen. If any one of us were caught on videotape shooting a gun at an unarmed man and killing him, we would be in jail to this day. But with that being said, the main point of contention that a lot of people have is what's happening with the officers that were on the platform with Mezzali that haven't been arrested. What's the accountability for them? And I think most of us feel that they're somehow involved with that, and it needs to be justice served with them. So that's what's happening in terms of that. I think the behavior of Tom Orloff, his dismissive attitude, his unwillingness to meet with people, and we're talking about 100 leaders at a time, his tardiness in terms of communicating to the community what is happening has led a lot of people to explore who will be the next district attorney in Alameda County. And I think a lot of people are taking that very seriously as they are exploring that possibility. So that's two of the highlights. And yesterday was a large protest in downtown Oakland. More than 1,000, couple of thousand people showed up. The emphasis was on peace at the behest of the Grant family. One of the highlights of that particular demonstration was Sean Bell's mother, Sean Bell from New York City, Valerie Bell, had sent a letter of support and condolences to Oscar Grant's mom, and that was read to the people that were there. After that particular demonstration was over, then we had more of what people would describe as the rebellion that took place in the streets of Oakland. This time, the city center was the target for a lot of people's anger. Some people think it's just people doing it gratuitously. I was out there last night, and really what I feel, Amy, is that even though it's not my personal get down, I just feel that there's a lot of people that are very angry, and this sort of incident is not one that can be resolved. It can't be resolved just with one or two actions. Some people are so angry, I don't think they know how to even express it. When you talk to them, you just hear stories about the cops have killed my friend, the cops have abused me, I've been abused, family's been abused. You hear those stories over and over again, and I think this particular egregious crime has triggered something in a lot of people. Some people can express it better. They have a sense of direction. They have an idea and a plan of action that they can follow. And others are just, I think, literally traumatized. And so I don't know how this will eventually play out, but right now in the city of Oakland, people are on the move in all different directions. And I think it would be for the good of the city, for justice to be served and this man to be convicted, and the four cops or the five cops that were on that platform to also be disciplined. Hopefully they do jail time as well.
Davey, a couple of questions about the actual incident. Number one, the cops you mentioned, since they were not actually involved in the shooting, I would assume that they were interviewed. Did they say, have any reports come out about what they claimed happened? And then also, what was it that triggered the initial incident? In other words, how was Grant initially arrested or apprehended by the cops?
Well, let me answer your last question first. From my understanding, there was an altercation on the BART train on New Year's Eve. And somehow, when the cops arrived at the Fruitvale station, they went and saw this group of men, and they pulled them off the train and handcuffed them. And to this day, it's not really clear if they were actually involved in an altercation. That you hear all types of rumors and stories going around. Just from my experience of being on the BART train when there's been fights, I've seen fights on Raider games and other sports, you know, sports days when lots of people have been on the train. I don't think it could have been anything really crazy, like somebody pulling a weapon and shooting or doing anything in the train that would have required the type of force that you saw applied to these gentlemen, especially with the killing of Grant. We all know the story about him pleading for his life. We all heard the stories about him trying to talk to the officers and calm everybody down. We also heard the stories that they had tasers pointed at the other men that were on the platform, and maybe even Grant himself. You have to talk to their lawyer, John Burris, to get all the details. But whatever the case, all we know is that there was an unarmed man whose hands were behind his back. He was on the face, was face down on a platform with another officer having his knee on his neck. And this gentleman was shot in front of plain view of hundreds of people. And I think, I don't think people can really appreciate how traumatic that is. I mean, we saw an execution, a modern-day lynching, take place before our very eyes, and we haven't seen the type of urgency and the type of immediate redress that I think people would like to see happen, considering, you know, what took place.
And the mayor of Oakland is Ron Dellums. What has been the mayor's response to all of this?
Well, he's been responding now. I mean, yesterday they announced that he's going to help set up some healing centers, but as far as I'm concerned, he was very slow. If you have something like this happen, you're the mayor of a city. It's up to you to assure the people that that something's going to be done. I mean, Giuliani and Mayor Bloomberg, you know, they pretty quickly addressed New York City after Sean Bell and Amadou Diallo. Whether or not I agreed with their position on it, it doesn't matter. It's at least they talk to people. In other cities, when you've seen these types of things happen, the leadership has stepped out and said something. Here, it was 6 or 7 days, and only after people were protesting and lobbying and having conversations and meeting. And in my opinion, is when the city started to catch on fire and people were jumping on cop cars, that all of a sudden you had all this movement. I'm sure it was going to happen sooner or later, but, I mean, 6 days after seeing an execution on your watch, and to me, is inexcusable. You should have been out there day one, the minute it happened. I mean, for us, just for us, like, we were on vacation, our show. We had already pre-recorded our things, and we were gone. We came off vacation just to follow the story and be a part of that, because we knew the way that media would look at this. The first thing they would do is not look at a young man who was shot unarmed and execution style. We knew that they were going to try and flip it and find out what his past was and maybe imply that maybe he deserved it. Did he have a criminal record? All these types of things. And some of those outlets do that. So it was important that we came up there and reminded people that this was an unarmed man who got killed in the presence of 4 or 5 officers who were able to restrain him. And from what we could see from the videotapes, he wasn't fighting or resisting anybody.
Davey D., Oakland is certainly in contrast to its neighbors not far away, San Jose and San Francisco, 400,000 people about in Oakland, high unemployment, high poverty. What is being called for right now? Bay Area legislators like Assemblyman Tom Amiano and State Senator Leland Yee have introduced bills to establish a civilian review board for the transit system's police. Is that adequate, do you feel, and what is being called for?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's adequate unless that civilian review board really has teeth. We've had how many civilian review boards since the days of the Panthers? You know, there was always a push to have some sort of accountability. You have a committee, people study it, you set things up, and then somehow you still have killings that go on. Remember, we're talking about Oscar Grant this time, but you have, like, what, 6 or 7 that took place in Oakland last year alone. And I remember the Gary King killing that took place when everybody was marching in Gina, Louisiana, for the Gina 6. You had a guy, Gary King, in North Oakland, who was shot in the back by an officer who had already shot 2 or 3 people over the past year or so, including somebody who I understand was handicapped in a wheelchair. So you never have the sort of punishment and discipline that I think many of us feels should be meted out to officers who are abusive. And keep in mind, right now, it makes news when we talk about people being killed. What we don't talk about all the time is all the disrespect to people that find themselves on the receiving end of some sort of abuse, having to witness a parent maybe being abused by the police, or a mother or father or cousin. When we've been out there and covering these stories, you hear this over and over and over and over and over again. People crying and will tell you a story about what they witnessed or what they've experienced. And I don't think people who are removed from that or who never experience some sort of brutality from the police can't really appreciate that. They think it's like, okay, well, you know, he's got arrested and that's it, and we should move on and let's turn and find out what else is going on in the news. No, this is very traumatic. It's in my opinion, it's like a terrorist act.
Well, David Yeo, I want to thank you very much for being with us. The history of Oakland is very interesting. Black Panthers founded there in 1966. Bobby Hutton, who was 17 years old, was killed there. We will continue to follow this story. Davey D, hip-hop journalist and activist, runs the popular website Davey D's Hip Hop Corner and DaveyD.com, co-host of Hard Knock Radio on sister station KPFA in Berkeley. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. Feeling fine from the party after New Year's Eve. You know the train's getting rowdy and having a couple drinks doesn't make me an alky. People started fighting and somebody pointed out me. Here come the bar police charging me. I don't author beef, I'm a father, please. I got a little girl at home, she only 4 years old. She my world, my flesh and bone, his tears started to roll. If they just looked him in his eye, they could see clear to his soul. But these cops only understand fear and control. Face down on the ground in a prone position. Bystanders start recording, cell phones are flipping, thinking he's another brother on the road to prison. They have no idea they gonna witness a lynching. The young brother was clinching, but he wasn't resisting it. Johannes Mezuri made a fatal decision as he rose to his feet and took hold of his seat. The entire train station froze in disbelief. Oscar, the father, barely over 20, with goals and the dreams of household and family. His last seconds on earth, he didn't know it could be. Only the dirty train station flow he could see. You hear the bullet explode through his fleece. You won't see an execution that cold in the streets. Damn, you see what happened? That cop started snapping. Cell phones they was grabbing. I had mine in the lining of my jacket. That cop was a cold-hearted. Shooting them in the back is an act of a savage. A flash from the gap that snatched your soul future. You can lose your life just by being a commuter. As soon as I get home, I upload. That's by Jasiri X, OG3 Oscar Grant tribute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, President-elect Barack Obama's pick to head the Department of Veterans Affairs, retired Army General Eric Shinseki, vowed to transform the VA during his confirmation hearing on Wednesday. Shinseki said he would reduce the long veterans' health care claim backlog and merge electronic health records of the Pentagon and the VA.
Through their service in uniform, veterans have sacrificed greatly, investing of themselves in the security, the safety, and the well-being of our nation. Their clients, and I use that term particularly, not just customers of our services, they are clients whom we represent and whose best interests are our sole reason for existence. It is our charge to address their changing needs over time and across the full range of support that our government has committed to providing them. Second, results. At the end of each day, our true measure of success is the timeliness, the quality, and the consistency of services and support we provide to veterans. We will set and meet objectives in each of those performance areas: timeliness, quality, consistency.
During the hearing, Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii praised Shinseki for speaking truth to power in the lead-up to the Iraq War. In 2003, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld essentially forced Shinseki out of the military for telling Congress that the U.S. would need several hundred thousand soldiers to stabilize Iraq after the invasion. At the time, Shinseki was Army Chief of Staff.
We're joined now in San Francisco by independent journalist Aaron Glantz, who's been covering the stories of U.S. military vets returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. He's author of the new book, The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans, and co-author of Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan, Eyewitness Accounts of the Occupations. Aaron Glantz, what do you feel is most important to understand right now as the Obama administration takes shape?
Well, I guess what I would say, Amy, is that for 6 years of war in Iraq, the Bush administration has done absolutely nothing to take care of the hundreds of thousands of wounded veterans coming home. And General Shinseki is really going to have his work cut out for him when he takes over because, you know, we've had people brought into the VA, turned away, who have committed suicide after coming back from the war with post-traumatic stress disorder. We've had people redeployed to Iraq even after they were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. We have 300,000 Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans coming home with traumatic brain injury, physical brain damage. We have 300,000 Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans who have filed disability claims with the federal government. And all of this is going to be on the plate of General Eric Shinseki when he takes over at VA.
Aaron, a couple of years ago, there was a Washington Post expose about the situation at Walter Reed Hospital. Has there been any improvement at all in the Bush administration in these final years after those exposés came out?
Well, I think, Juan, the important thing for your viewers and listeners to understand is that Walter Reed is not even a VA hospital. Walter Reed is a military hospital. And that was the shabby treatment that the veterans were experiencing when they were even still in the military. So very little has been done at all for the veterans after they get discharged, when they go from Walter Reed back to their own communities. And in many cases, there is no medical services at all, because remember that many people serving in Iraq and Afghanistan come from rural communities where the VA doesn't even have a hospital.
You've been writing a lot about homeless veterans. Can you talk about how many homeless veterans on the street at this point and what you feel needs to be done?
Well, we have 200,000 homeless veterans in this country. On every night, 200,000 people who have put on the uniform and served this country sleep homeless on the streets. And I think the single most important thing that General Shinseki could do as head of the VA is to trust our veterans when they come forward and say that they're wounded, because it's the lack of that trust that causes our veterans to fall through the cracks and end up homeless on the street. In my book, The War Comes Home, I tell the story of Specialist James Eggemeyer of Stuart, Florida, who came home from Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder, a back injury, and a shoulder injury. He couldn't hold the job, so he filed a disability claim with the federal government. And it took him 8 months to have his disability claim heard. And during that time, he lost his house. During that time, he lost contact with his son. He had to move into his truck. He was self-medicating because he wasn't getting proper medical care, so he crashed his truck. And he was living homeless on the street less than a year after coming home from Iraq. And if General Shinseki would institute a policy at the VA where we simply believed injured veterans when they came home, when they said they were disabled, then none of that would have happened. He would have recovered after he came home from Iraq rather than ending up homeless on the street.
One of the things I've heard often, you're mentioning this whole issue of recognition of the injuries that soldiers are constantly confront, even at VA hospitals, being able to get a recognition of the degree of their injuries. How would that be? How could Shinseki change that?
Well, imagine that you come home from Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder, a mental wound, or traumatic brain injury, physical brain damage often caused by a roadside bomb. The first thing that you have to do just to get in the door at the VA is to fill out a 26-page form where you substantiate exactly how you were wounded, where you get letters of support from your battle buddies, from your commanders, you subpoena your own Army records, often with the help of your congressperson, and you present to the VA a gigantic claim folder which they then sit on for an extended period of time. And that's just to get in the door. So we take our veterans when they're most wounded and most vulnerable and exploit them by making them fill out a mound of paperwork just to get in the door. Now, what Shinseki could do is, rather than hire more bureaucrats, which is what he told the Veterans Affairs Committee yesterday that he would do, he could get rid of this process, and he could institute a new process which would be similar to the way the IRS handles our taxes, which is that you file your tax return, the IRS believes you, they send you your refund check, and later on, they go back and audit you. And I think most of your viewers and listeners would be surprised to know that our government is more hostile to our wounded veterans than the IRS is to taxpayers.
Aaron Glantz, what about the proposal by a military psychologist? It was reported in Stars and Stripes that in May, he suggested that troops suffering from PTSD should be eligible for the Purple Heart, which would help remove the disorder stigma, the Pentagon rejecting the proposal.
Well, this is yet another sign by the Bush administration that they disrespect our service members who come home wounded. They didn't want to give the Purple Heart to people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder because they were saying that a mental wound is different than a physical wound, which is a terrible thing, a terrible message for them to send, because the veterans coming home have trouble. You have trouble admitting that you have a problem. And now they're piling on top of that their refusal to admit on a systematic level from the government that PTSD is indeed an injury. One of the things that we hope, that I hope that General Shinseki will do is do a presumption of service connectedness for veterans suffering from PTSD. In other words, if you served in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you come home and you say that you have PTSD, that the VA should assume that you got that in the war, not from a auto accident, not from some experience growing up, but perhaps your experience seeing your buddies killed, or your experience killing an innocent civilian, that those might be the incidences that caused you to develop post-traumatic stress disorder. And I would be very hopeful that that would be a step that General Shinseki will take. But again, he wasn't asked about that either at the confirmation hearing yesterday.
Now, in the last year or so, we've heard about the reports, at least finally documenting the existence of a Gulf War disease for the Gulf War veterans. What is going to be the impact in terms of VA treatment of Gulf War veterans?
Well, this is another very important question. We are 17 years after the Persian Gulf War of 1991, and veterans of that war are still fighting to get disability compensation and health care. And for the last 17 years, up until about 2 months ago, the VA had said that Gulf War syndrome simply didn't exist, and they called it, quote-unquote, undiagnosed illness. And one problem with that is if you call it undiagnosed illness, then there's no way to treat it because you're pretty much throwing up your hands. So General Shinseki has said that he will invest more money into research of Gulf War illness and how to treat it, which is positive, you know, a little bit late, 17 years after the fact. I think another question that we should be asking is, what is the quote-unquote Gulf War illness of the war that we're involved in right now? Is it our troops' exposure to depleted uranium, for example? Is it our troops, the pills that our troops were forced to take before they went into this war? Might those things have long-term effects on our Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans? Shouldn't we get ahead of the curve this time and not wait until 17 years after the war to begin to look at how to treat and compensate people who served in it? So these are all questions that I hope General Shinseki will look into. President-elect Obama had a very good record as a senator. He's picked somebody who has a reputation for truth-telling because he stood up to Donald Rumsfeld before this war in Iraq. But it's going to be a lot of work. And Shinseki and Obama are going to have to deal not only with the VA bureaucracy, but also our country's apathy towards this war. And our country's fixation on the economy, on the situation in the Middle East. These are real issues. But we can't forget about the 1.8 million Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans who are coming back into hard communities. And if we don't deal with this now, we're going to be looking at an increase in those statistics we were talking about at the beginning of this interview, the 200,000 veterans sleeping homeless on the streets of this country, the 18 veterans who commit suicide every day in this country. This is our opportunity right now to nip this in the bud, make sure that the Vietnam experience doesn't repeat itself.
Aaron Glantz, I want to thank you very much for being with us, independent journalist, well-known as a Pacifica reporter, spent a good deal of time in Iraq. His new book is called The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. And just to remember again, the man up to head Veterans Affairs, General Shinseki, testifying just before the invasion, saying that several hundred thousand soldiers would be needed to stabilize Iraq after an invasion. Paul Wolfowitz publicly rebuking him, saying his comments were wildly off the mark, in part because Iraqis would welcome America as liberators. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we go directly to the Middle East, to Gaza. Juan?
Well, Israeli forces are continuing to pound Gaza City, hitting civilian targets, including a UN building, a hospital, and a building housing several media organizations, in some of the heaviest shelling in nearly 3 weeks. Israeli troops, backed by helicopter gunships, tanks, and heavy guns, have pushed deeply into densely populated neighborhoods. Thousands of Gaza City residents are fleeing their homes. The Palestinian death toll now stands at least 1,045, at least half of them civilians. Another 4,860 have been injured. 13 Israelis have been killed, including 4 by friendly fire.
We go now to Gaza to speak with Dr. Musa Al-Haddad, a retired physician. He lives in Gaza City. Welcome to Democracy Now! Tell us where you are and what's happening right now, Dr. Al-Haddad.
Well, I am in Gaza City itself. What's happening is a state that is almost impossible to describe. Israeli army has escalated the attack on civilians since last night. I did not have a single minute of sleep for the last probably 18 hours. They've been bombardment every day, every minute, all night long. My house was rocking all the time. And this morning, when the sun rose, we could at least look from the window, and I could see, as you probably have seen on the TV, smoke coming of buildings, civilian buildings, apartment buildings. Actually, two hospitals were bombarded this morning, Al-Quds and Al-Wafa Hospital. Al-Wafa Hospital is a hospital for handicaps, by the way, and old people. Media apartment was also hit this morning, not far from my house. That's Abu Dhabi news agency. So wherever, it's extremely unsafe now, even inside our homes. Smoke everywhere. I could see cluster bombs being fired this morning, and the phosphorus bombs now are used freely on these civilians. I'm sure you have seen it on the TV.
Dr. Al-Haddad, we heard that white phosphorus was dropped on the UN compound, that hundreds of people, families, were there taking refuge. We discussed white phosphorus yesterday with Human Rights Watch. Can you talk, as a doctor, about the effects of the burning? For example, they say it can't be put out, the fires that it creates, just by pouring water on it. In fact, that exacerbates
it. Actually, if you pour water on it, it gets worse. If you get this burn, number one, those people who get exposed to white phosphorus get severe respiratory distress. They can hardly breathe, and then the exposed skin gets burned. If you put water on it, the burning increase becomes worse, so you cannot really do much about it. And if the affected area was exposed too much for white phosphorus, it burns the skin, muscles, and deep to the bones. So eventually, a lot of these patients will lose some of their limbs.
Dr. Al-Haddad, we've just been joined by Christopher Gunness. He's the spokesperson for the UN Relief and Works Agency. Can you tell us, Chris Gunness, what has happened to the UN compound in Gaza?
Well, this morning there were 3 rounds of white phosphorus which landed in our compound in Gaza. That set ablaze the main warehouse and the big workshop we have there for vehicles. At the time, there were 700 or so people displaced from the fighting. There were full fuel tankers there. The Israeli army had been given all the coordinates of all the facilities, including this one. They also knew that there were fuel tankers laden with fuel compound, and they would have known that there were hundreds of people who'd taken refuge. The Israeli defense minister apologized to the Secretary General for this, but for us, we need deeds and not words. We have to get on with our humanitarian task. Amazingly, our operations are continuing today, and I have to pay tribute to the extraordinary bravery and commitment of our staff in Gaza. We're continuing with our food distributions. We're picking up humanitarian goods from the crossings, and we are doing health care as best we can.
And from this latest strike, were there any casualties in your compound?
There were at least 3. That's when I was last able to talk to office, but it's possible there are more. But for the moment, 3 people injured. And it, again, tragically illustrates that when you have this on and off the military machine, when you have rockets flying out of Gaza, humanitarian workers and innocent civilians are going to get caught in the crossfire. Of course, we condemn the rockets that come out of Gaza, but the world has been revulsed by the pictures that have come out of Gaza, which is why today we've, on the ground, utterly endorsed and back the call of the world's top diplomat, Ban Ban Ki-moon. He's the conscience of the world. He's come here with a Security Council resolution which says stop the fighting, and his parties on the ground who are continuing to fight are doing so in defiance and in isolation.
And this use of phosphorus munitions, your response to that?
Well, I'm not a military person, but as a colleague of mine said to me in Gaza today, who, you know, has a military background and knows these things, it looks like white phosphorus, it smells like white phosphorus, and it burns like white phosphorus. We weren't able initially to put the fighting out because we had only conventional fire extinguishers. White phosphorus needs sand, and we didn't have sand in quantities. But I'm pleased to say that the Red Cross fire services have managed to make a compound and are now fighting the blaze.
Chris Gunness, in addition to the three people you say that were wounded there, what about the thousands of tons of supplies? Is that right? Food, medical supplies, other aid in this building?
Yes, I don't have a handle on exact quantities, but there's no doubt that aid was destroyed, aid paid for with your tax dollars and mine. It's a tragic piece of symbolism that the very pallets that we deliver humanitarian assistance on are on fire in Gaza. You know, what more tragic symbolism could there be of the situation that we find ourselves in today?
Ehud Barak said this was a mistake, the attack on the UN compound. Your response?
Well, we want deeds and not words. Our workers and indeed the civilians in Gaza have come in harm's way too many times. This on-off with the pause, so-called, is not good enough. It's woefully inadequate because, of course, we have to pre-position our aid before the actual pause takes place. So there's heavy fighting where I am, the booms. Which is slightly distracting. We have to provision our aid at our food distribution centres. We have to get our medical supply to hospitals, which we are doing our best to supply. We have got to get fuel to hospitals, because most of the hospitals in Gaza today are running 24/7 on emergency generators. So babies are on life support systems, patients, the dying, the elderly, the sick, who need electricity, are life-threatening situations. So we are continuing with our work, but we say, please, will the parties on the ground listen to the call of the world's top diplomat today? On his first day of his peace mission to Israel, he's again endorsed the call of the Security Council for an immediate ceasefire. And this terrible attack on the United Nations headquarters is another tragic illustration of what happens when we don't have a ceasefire. There has to be a permanent ceasefire.
And I'd like to ask Dr. Musa El-Haddad, who is still on the line with us. The Israelis say that they keep notifying the population to flee areas that they are attacking. What does this mean to you? Where could you possibly go to flee to safety?
Well, number one, let me tell you that I've heard from many people whose houses have been demolished, bombarded, that no warning has been given. Some people were given warning through the Red Cross, but many people were not warned. So those who leave their houses, they just go either to shelters, UNRWA shelters, or it's not actually shelters, schools, and or to their relatives. But let me just add a comment to what Mr. Ehud Olmert said, that he apologized, that was a mistake. If that was one mistake, I tell you right now on air that they have committed hundreds of mistakes during the last 3 weeks. You know, what about all these apartment buildings that civilians occupy? Children and families are trapped in elevators and under the stairs. Children and women bleeding in the streets, and the Israeli army tanks are not allowing Red Cross or humanitarian aid to go and help them. The ambulances are not allowed to go in. They bleed for 4 hours, and we can hear them on the radio asking for help and somebody to come and help them and take them. Dead bodies in the streets in Tal el-Hawa area in the southwest of Gaza. It's I tell you, this is a disaster on humans. This is a human disaster in the 21st century, and everybody is looking. As a physician, I'm telling you, you know, even now, you know, I just hope they stop this, whatever you want to call it, massacre or what, but I hope that they just stop it instantaneously, and even if they do, there will be years to come. People suffering psychologically, handicapped people, you know, we already started seeing things like this. So I don't know how long we have to take until this thing stops. And I just hope that Mr. Bush is enjoying his time playing with his cat or dog right now.
Dr. Musa Haldad, we'd like to ask you to stay on with us. We're going to go to break. But Christopher Gunness, if you haven't left us, yes, spokesperson for UNRWA. Just a comment on UNICEF. It's rare that it speaks out. And Veneman is the head of UNICEF, used to be the head of Department of Agriculture here in the United States. But UNICEF has condemned the Gaza attack in a rare statement. It urged an immediate ceasefire, calling the deaths of children tragic and unacceptable. Final comments, Christopher Gunness.
Well, it is entirely unacceptable, and of course we're very gratified and welcome the statement by Anne Veneman. Too many innocent children, too many babies, too many women have been killed. And of course, in Israel too, there have been rockets, which we condemn. The pictures have revulsed the world, and Ban Ki-moon has come here as the conscience of the world. He's expressing the revulsion of the world and is calling for the rockets to stop and for the fighting in Gaza to stop. Enough innocent civilians have been killed. It has to stop.
Christopher Gunness, thanks for being with us, spokesperson for UN Relief and Works Agency. Dr. Haldad will stay with us. When we come back from break, we're joined by Rabbi Michael Lerner, an open letter to Barack Obama. Rabbis have taken out a full-page ad in the New York Times to make a statement about Gaza. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
A coalition of American rabbis and other religious, cultural, and community leaders bought a full-page ad in the New York Times on Wednesday calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and for President-elect Barack Obama to convene an international Middle East peace conference. The initiative was led by Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine. Lerner said the group had to buy ad space because the nation's major newspapers are not giving room for this perspective.
Rabbi Michael Lerner joins us in San Francisco. Welcome to Democracy Now! You've been listening as we've spoke to Christopher Gunness, UN Relief and Works Agency, as well as Dr. Haldad, who is trapped in his house in Gaza, observing what is happening outside. Rabbi Lerner, talk about your message. Who put out this ad and what it says?
Well, it was put out by Tikkun magazine, and we are actually trying now to get other liberal and progressive people around the country to help us go to Tikkun.org so that we can reproduce this in the Washington Post and in other major media. Unfortunately, the media, except for Democracy Now! And Pacifica and a few other places, are obliterating the message that many, many American Jews and other religious leaders, spiritual leaders, and just American citizens are outraged at the immorality of what is happening. So we're demanding an immediate ceasefire, but we're also asking for President Obama to take an immediate leadership in convening an international conference, because the direction that was laid out by Senator Clinton yesterday, that she said Obama and she agreed on, which would call for, would say that there are no negotiations with Hamas until Hamas recognizes the state of Israel, which of course is not going to happen. Hamas is going to be agreeable to a ceasefire, but it is, and maybe a long-term ceasefire, 20 or 30 years, but it's not going to recognize Israel. So, and this policy is non-starter. It's a stupid policy, and it's exactly in reverse of what Obama said he would do during the elections, when he was saying he would negotiate with people, including Iran and Syria, despite the fact that he abhorred their policies. Why in Israel do we have the one time when he won't negotiate, won't talk to Hamas? Well, of course, the answer is obvious. It's that the Israel lobby, combining extremely right-wing Jews in this country with a powerful Christian Zionist movement, have blocked out of public discourse all of the moral sentiments of the American public, which would be outraged at what's going on in Gaza at this moment, and more generally understand that the best interests of Israel and Israeli security lies in reconciliation with the Palestinian people, not in trying to wipe them out.
Rabbi Lerner, in your open letter that to Barack Obama, you raise your concern that, having met him several times in the past, that you saw a great hope in terms of the Middle East and in his policies, but that you were concerned, starting with the election campaign last year, that you saw a change in his direction. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, you know, in my conversations with Obama, Obama came to a Tikkun conference in 1996, and I spoke to him about these issues in 2006. And he was very much aligned with the Tikkun perspective, which is a perspective that says that the best interest of Israel lies in peace and reconciliation with the Palestinian people. But the pressures that have been brought upon him during the campaign and now afterwards are immense. You can't, you cannot underestimate the amount of push that is going on all around him. And remember that last week, the Senate voted overwhelmingly, that is, unanimously, to support the Israeli position. And the House voted, I think it was 405 to 5, in support of the Israeli position. There is nothing in coming from the other direction, and that's why those of us who really care about the security of the Palestinian people and the Israeli people need to stand up and speak very loudly at this time, and to ask President Obama to intervene. To intervene directly, and to not listen to all those forces that are saying to him, forget about the Israel thing. Don't risk your political capital on Israel-Palestine. Turn to other issues. Now, this is happening, as you see, and you've beautifully demonstrated. This is happening, this moral outrage, this a violation of human rights is happening on a daily basis right now, and we need leadership right now.
We're going to end with Dr. Musa Al-Haddad back in Gaza, retired physician living in Gaza City as best he can right now. Dr. Al-Haddad, why don't you leave your home? How far are the Israeli troops from your home?
Why don't I leave my home?
Yes.
Well, number one, there is no way to go. As you know, all the borders are closed, and if I leave, all the places are unsafe now. As we mentioned in the beginning, the civilians are trapped into this between, and this is a game being played between the politicians, and the civilians are paying the price. Number one, all the borders of Gaza Strip are closed. As you know, also the sea is closed. You cannot leave. And as a human being, I would like to leave when I want and where I want. I don't want to leave because Israel wants me to leave. So the Israeli army now is pretty close to me, the tanks. Nobody is safe in this area, and as you know, more than 300 children have been killed so far, and some of them are as young as 5 months old.
Dr. Moussa Haldad, the program is ending now. I want to thank you for being with us, and
my pleasure, dear.
Wish you safety. A retired physician living in Gaza City, his daughter Leila Haldad is the journalist who we've interviewed, who writes the popular blog Raising Yusuf. Yusuf is Dr. Moussa Haldad's grandson. That does it for our broadcast. DemocracyNow.org is our website. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.